Right, good morning everybody. Special welcome to our guests this morning, and I guess a lesser welcome to the old faces that we're used to. We've been doing a series on the Messianic Psalms, and last time we were in Psalm 40, and we looked at what we called the pit and the pierced ear in the paths of God. And it was quite a personal message. I shared a few things about my father, which I think for mum was probably death by a thousand sermon points. So it's not going to be so personal this morning. No more, oh, she said good. No more skeletons coming out of the Gordon closet. There's lots of things I could say about Fraser especially. But unfortunately, the only story that I'm legally allowed to tell about Fraser is the story of why I can't tell any stories. And that was because when we were little, I used to see him doing some naughty things, and I'm not sure whether I bribed him or he bought me off, but he would buy me these big boxes of Pebble chocolates to pay me off so that I would not tell mum or dad.
It was so easy.
But I'm pretty sure that that was for a limited time, and I haven't seen any Pebbles for about 30 years now, so yeah. I think it's now referee for all. All right. This morning we're obviously in another Messianic Psalm. Last time was Psalm 40. And we've advanced a long way onto Psalm 41 this morning. Sometimes the Messianic Psalms are an entire chapter. Psalm 2, Psalm 22 are examples of that. Sometimes they're a portion of the chapter. Sometimes they're just one verse. The one we're going to look at this morning is just one verse. And it's to do with the betrayal. The betrayal of Jesus. And we're actually going to spend, even though it's about the betrayal of Jesus, we're going to spend basically all our time in the Old Testament, strangely enough. But anyway, if you've got your Bibles, open them up to Psalm 41. This whole theme on the betrayal is going to be over two sermons. Okay, I sort of had too much to pack into one sermon. So we're going to sort of lay all the groundwork today, look at some of the Old Testament types, especially in the life of David, what that teaches about the betrayal of Jesus. And then we'll, next time, look at it more from a personal point of view and even an end times point of view. So if you've got in your Bibles, we'll just read from verse 7. It's a psalm of David, and it says, starting verse 7, all who hate me whisper together against me. Against me they devise my hurt, saying a wicked thing is poured out upon him, that when he lies down, he will not rise up again. And even my close friend in whom I trusted, who ate my bread, has lifted up his heel against me. The context of the psalm really is that the enemies of David were sniffing an opportunity. They were thinking, he's down, he's possibly down for the count. We can move in here, we can do something. And when we read the psalm, David always had his enemies, but what it was that really, really hurt him was that there was actually one that was actually his friend who was actually betraying him. He says that in that verse 9 that we read, even my close friend in whom I trusted, who ate my bread, has lifted up his heel against me. So he had this close friend, and even that close friend had now turned and was starting to betray him in this moment of need. And hopefully, does that verse 9, does that ring any bells with anyone? Yep. A couple of people. Jesus picked this one verse, and he said that verse had to be fulfilled in his life. I'll just read it out to you. It's from John, chapter 13. He says, this is Jesus speaking, he says, "I know those I have chosen, but this is to fulfill the scripture that he who shares my bread has lifted up his heel against me." And after he said this, Jesus was troubled in spirit, and he testified, "I tell you the truth, one of you is going to betray me." And his disciples stared at one another, at a loss to know which of them he meant. So this whole theme, obviously today and next time, is going to be about betrayal. Betrayal kind of has a few different thoughts. I don't know whether you guys can think of any times in your life where maybe you've felt like you've been betrayed. Possibly.
By politicians.
By politicians, yep. Yeah. When you look at that word betray, I looked at what Mr. Google had to say, and he said that it's used in a few different contexts, a few different ways. It can kind of mean a failure in expectations, kind of at a lower level. An example would be, you know, Fraser would have won many running races at schools had his legs not betrayed him. Normally just after the starter's gun went off. It can mean like a failure in expectation. It can actually mean to disclose a secret. To disclose a secret. So going back to the pebbles thing, there may be a chance that I actually betray his confidence and trust and tell you some of the stories about him. It can mean disloyalty, and that's kind of more of what we're going to start to get to today. You know, you might talk about someone betraying their spouse, a husband betraying his wife, you know, not being true to their vows, maybe. It's that betrayal of someone that's really close. And then at its kind of worst, I guess, is really treachery. Betrayal also means treachery. It kind of means to intentionally expose someone or even a nation to danger, normally through siding with the enemy. And that's what we see with Judas, and that's what we see with the example that we're going to look at this morning. So I wanted to understand more of what actually happened in the life of David. Because Jesus said that this verse, yes, it's about David, but it's also about me. And so I wanted to look at, okay, what actually happened with David, and what can that teach us about the betrayal that Jesus went through? Who's heard of a man called Ahithophel? Yep. Yep. Okay. Most scholars say that this verse 9 here is, in its context in which David wrote it, it's about this man, Ahithophel. So let's have a look. It's quite a, we're going to have a look in 2 Samuel, chapter 15. I'm just going to pick out certain parts because the story kind of goes over about three chapters, so we can't really read it all. But the context of this story is that David's own son, Absalom, is actually making a bid for the kingdom. He's trying to usurp David's rightful rule. He's trying to take the kingdom for himself. And in 2 Samuel chapter 15, we'll start in verse 10. It says, "But Absalom sent spies throughout all the tribes of Israel, saying, 'As soon as you hear the sound of the trumpet, then you shall say, Absalom is king in Hebron.' Then 200 men went with Absalom from Jerusalem, who were invited, and they went innocently, and they did not know anything. And Absalom sent for Ahithophel, the Gilonite, David's counselor, from his city Gilo, while he was offering the sacrifices. And the conspiracy was strong, for the people increased continually with Absalom. And then a messenger came to David, saying, 'The hearts of the men of Israel are with Absalom.' And David said to all his servants who were with him at Jerusalem, arise and let us flee, for otherwise none of us shall escape from Absalom. Go in haste, or he will overtake us quickly and bring down calamity on us and strike the city with the edge of the sword. So this is actually the first mention of this guy Ahithophel. And it tells us that he was David's counselor. Does anyone know anything else about this man? Yeah?
Was it the father-in-law?
Yeah, I think what from what I've read, grandfather-in-law. Yeah. So what I read anyway is that he was Bathsheba's grandfather. And we probably know all the story about the sin with Bathsheba, all that entailed. So Ahithophel is the grandfather of Bathsheba, so basically the grandfather-in-law of David. And he was basically one of his closest men. He was David's go-to guy, if you liked. If David needed a sounding board, this is the guy that you go to for advice. He was that close to David. And we see, even from the very start here, that there's the start of a conspiracy actually within another conspiracy. There's a betrayal within a larger betrayal. Ahithophel is going to betray David, but it's actually in the context of this larger betrayal of David's own son, Absalom. So we'll come back to Absalom a little bit later. But we'll just carry on with this guy, Ahithophel. If you have a look in verse 30 of 2 Samuel. So David has just found out that Absalom is trying to take the throne, and he knows he has to run. In verse 30 of that same chapter, it says, "And David went up the ascent of the Mount of Olives, and he wept as he went, and his head was covered as he walked barefoot. Then all the people who were with him each covered his head and went up weeping as well. Now someone told David, saying, Ahithophel is among the conspirators with Absalom. And David said, O Lord, I pray, make the counsel of Ahithophel foolishness. And it happened as David was coming to the summit where where God was worshipped, that behold, Hushai the Archite met him with his coat torn and dust on his head. And David said to them, if you pass over with me, then you will be a burden to me. But if you return to the city and say to Absalom, I will be your servant, O king, as I have been your father's servant in time past, so I will now be your servant, then you can thwart the counsel of Ahithophel for me." So David was really concerned when he heard that this man, his dear friend, his counselor, Ahithophel, has actually joined the conspiracy. He's gone over to the side of Absalom, and he actually prays, "O Lord, please make the counsel of Ahithophel foolishness." Later on in Samuel, it actually talks about the counsel of Ahithophel, and it actually says, I'll just find the exact quote. Maybe I won't. It basically said that his counsel was like inquiring of God. So if you went to this guy, Ahithophel, asked him something, it was fairly much like asking the Lord something. That was his counsel was always that true and accurate and reliable. And so David's obviously concerned. But we're introduced also to this other character, this guy, Hushai, the Archite. He also was a counselor for David, and he wanted to go with David. But David said, no, it's actually going to be better for me if you go back to Absalom and say that, as I served David, I will now serve you, and try to thwart the counsel of Ahithophel. All right, and then just to get the story over a little bit quickly. It came to a pivotal point where Absalom was seeking the counsel of Ahithophel, and Hushai was there as well, as to how they could take out David. And Ahithophel said, you should go with 12,000 men and you shall strike David when he's weary and he's weak and you'll be able to kill him. And Hushai says, actually, that's a foolish plan. He's obviously working for David, remember. It's a silly plan. What you need, you know, he says that David has the heart of a lion and him and his men fight like the heart of a lion. What you need to do is really get all your men together and you need to lead them out yourself. And obviously he's planning something different there. If you have a look in chapter 17, verse 14. It says, then Absalom and all the men of Israel said, the counsel of Hushai the Archite is better than the counsel of Ahithophel. For the Lord had ordained to thwart the good counsel of Ahithophel in order that the Lord may bring about calamity on Absalom. And then finally, we find the reaction of Ahithophel. He hasn't been listened to. He's kind of like a God speaking in his own mind. And he hasn't been listened to. In verse 23, it says, now when Ahithophel saw that his counsel was not followed, he saddled his donkey and he arose and he went to his house, to his city. He set his house in order and he strangled or hung himself. Thus he died and was buried in the grave of his father. So, I know that's kind of a lot of background, quite quickly, maybe. The actual story goes over three chapters. But what you kind of find is that this guy, Ahithophel, was basically the Old Testament Judas. And there's a number of just little points that I want to bring out. Firstly, we see that Ahithophel was one of David's, he was one of his most trusted men. He was right on the inner circle. Just as Judas had that privileged position of being, you know, among the 12 disciples that got to see everything that Jesus did, got to hear everything that Jesus said, got to be with him that whole time. We also see that David really loved Ahithophel. It probably doesn't come out so much in these passages in 2 Samuel, but in the Psalms it does come out. Have a look at, maybe just keep one finger back here, but have a look in Psalm 55. Psalm 55, the whole psalm fairly much is talking about this rebellion that happened in the time of Absalom, and especially to do with this close friend Ahithophel. And look specifically at verse 12 through to 14. He says, this is David speaking of Ahithophel. He says, for it is not an enemy who reproaches me, then I could bear it. Nor is it one who hates me who has exalted himself against me. Then I could hide myself from him. But it is you, a man, my equal, my companion, and my familiar friend. We who had sweet fellowship together and walked in the house of God in the throng. So he's saying, if it was just an enemy that was against me, I'd be able to cope. But it's not, it's actually you. It's you, my close friend. This one that we broke bread, we had fellowship together. It's you that has actually turned and betrayed me. And obviously it gives us something of the glimpse of our Lord. You know, Jesus knew that Judas was going to betray him. But that doesn't mean that it was easy for Jesus. You know, in that verse from John that we read out before, when Jesus said to them, I tell you that one of you is going to betray me. It says he was troubled in spirit. This was not an easy thing. You know, and he had given Judas this amazing position, really. Judas got to see all the miracles of Jesus. He got to hear all the amazing truth. He got to see it all. And if there was anyone who really was going to follow the Lord and turn, it should have been Judas. But he actually, despite that love, despite that friendship, despite, you know, all that he saw and heard, he still turned. But Jesus, on his part, always showed love. Again, from that passage in John that we read, when Jesus said, "I tell you, one of you is going to betray me," all the disciples just, "Is it me? Is it you?" Like, no one knew. Who is it? Which means that Jesus treated them all like equals. It wasn't like everyone just suddenly thought, "That's going to be Judas. I know that's Judas." Jesus loved them all. Even at the very act, when Judas came to betray him, Jesus said, "Friend, do what you have to do quickly." Called him a friend. All right, but we see with Ahithophel that despite David's friendship, that Ahithophel was willing to betray David when the pressure came on. He was a gun, or in this case, a counsel for hire. If there was something that he could kind of gain out of it, then he was willing to swap sides. And it's kind of the same with Judas. He was willing to betray Jesus if there was something really that he could get out of it. We also see in the plan of Ahithophel how his counsel was to take all these men from the king and go and get David. And we see that didn't actually play out because God thwarted that plan. But in the life of Jesus, that did play out. We know that Judas went and came with something like 500 to 600 Roman soldiers to arrest Jesus. And also how it all ends. You know, once he found that his plan hadn't really worked, Ahithophel, it says, departed. He went and he hung himself. And Matthew actually picks up basically those exact words that Judas departed. He left and he hung himself. He's again showing that Judas in the New Testament goes back to this guy, Ahithophel. Even the location of where it all happened, we haven't really looked into this, but it happened around the Kidron Valley and the Mount of Olives when you read the whole thing in 2 Samuel. So the first mention of the Kidron Valley in the Bible is actually in the 2 Samuel 15, to do with that David had to cross it at the time of his betrayal. And then the last mention of the Kidron in the Bible is actually Jesus crossing the Kidron on the day of his betrayal. So it's still played out all on the same areas. All right, so that's a bit of an overview of this guy, Ahithophel, who speaks to us of Judas. But as I said before, this betrayal is only a betrayal within a larger betrayal. It's a conspiracy within a larger conspiracy. And so I wanted to have a look at that as well. Because we've sort of touched on very briefly that, yes, Ahithophel jumped sides, but this larger conspiracy was actually David's own son, Absalom, who was actually trying to take the throne. So have a look, still back in 2 Samuel, chapter 14. We're just going to bring out some parallels, if you like, in the life of Absalom to do with the one who wants to take God's throne, which is actually Satan. Because in the life of Judas, we actually find that Judas wasn't working alone. His betrayal was part of a bigger betrayal. And it was actually Satan that was actually working behind the scenes. And there's a few interesting things in the life of Absalom that kind of point to that picture as well. So we're going to start in 2 Samuel 14, verse 25. It says, "Now in all Israel was no one as handsome as Absalom, and so highly praised. From the sole of his foot to the crown of his head, there was no defect in him." It must have been tough. It says, "When he cut the hair of his head, and it was at the end of every year that he cut it, for it was heavy on him, so he cut it. He weighed the hair of his head at 200 shekels by the king's weight," which is probably it's just under 2 kgs. So if you think of like two big blocks of cheese, you know, 2 1-kg things of cheese. I mean, hair doesn't weigh very well. My hair doesn't weigh very much, so I don't know what this looked like. So here we have a beautiful man. Didn't know that such things existed. Well, I don't really know exactly what that would look like, but in your imagination, whatever you're thinking of, that's Absalom from the top of his head to his toes. No blemish whatsoever. Perfect in beauty. That's Absalom. And as a type, as a picture, it actually speaks of the light bearer, Lucifer, the one that was actually created perfect in beauty. I'll read out, there's two main passages about, really about the fall of Satan in Isaiah 14 and Ezekiel 28. And I'll just read out what it says from Ezekiel 28 about him. It says, "This is what the Sovereign Lord says. You were the model of perfection, full of wisdom and perfect in beauty. And you were in Eden, the garden of God, and every precious stone adored you. The ruby, the topaz, the emerald, the onyx, the jasper, the sapphire and the turquoise. And your settings and mountings were made of gold. On the day you were prepared, you were created, they were prepared, and you were anointed as a guardian cherub, for so I ordained you. And you were on the holy mount of God, and you walked among the fiery stones, and you were blameless in your ways from the day you were created until wickedness was found in you." So he was perfect, perfect in his wisdom, perfect in his beauty when he was created. And we get that same kind of picture here with Absalom, perfect in his beauty from head to toe, but unfortunately not perfect in his intentions. We'll just read the next little part in Samuel, in chapter 15. Just do verses 1 to 6. It says, "Now it came about after this that Absalom provided for himself a chariot and horses and 50 men as runners before him. And Absalom used to rise early and stand beside the way to the gate. And it happened that when any man had a suit to come to the king for judgment, Absalom would call to him and say, 'From what city are you?' And he would say, 'Your servant is from one of the tribes of Israel.' And then Absalom would say to him, 'See, your claims are good and they are right, but no man listens to you on the part of the king.' And moreover, Absalom would say, 'Oh, that one would appoint me judge in the land. Then every man who has any suit or cause could come to me and I would give him justice.' And it happened that when a man came near to prostrate himself before him, he would put out his hand and take hold of him and kiss him. And in this manner, Absalom dealt with all Israel who came to the king for judgment. And so Absalom stole away the hearts of the men of Israel." So you have this picture of really this rebellion starting to happen. This beautiful man's not beautiful in his intentions. And there's kind of two points that I just want to bring out from this little passage. One is that Absalom wasn't content with being the king's son. He wasn't content, even though he had that privileged role, he wasn't content to be the king's son. He wanted to be the king. He wanted to be the head honcho, if you like, the top dog. He wasn't willing just to stay in his position. And again, in its imagery form, it's a picture actually of the fall of Satan. From that Isaiah 14 passage, we read this. It says, "How you have fallen from heaven, O morning star, son of the dawn. You said in your heart, I will ascend to heaven. I will raise my throne above the stars of God. And I will sit enthroned on the Mount of Assembly. And I will ascend above the tops of the clouds. And I will make myself like the Most High." So you see that same kind of attitude that originated in Satan to actually be the Most High himself and to take the throne, to usurp that of God's kingdom. We see that coming out in Absalom here. And secondly, it's just this way that Absalom went about this. It says that the method that he used to actually usurp the kingdom, he started to spread disharmony amongst the people in Israel. He started to say really bad things about the king. There's nobody really. The king's not really going to listen to you. If I was the one, you know, you would actually get justice for your cause. So he starts to spread these seeds of distrust and disharmony amongst them. And it's interesting, again, when you look at it in terms of the picture of Satan, you see this exact same thing. In the Ezekiel passage, it actually says in 28 verse 16, it says, "Through your widespread trade or traffic, you were filled with violence and you sinned. And I expelled you, O guardian cherub, from among the fiery stones." We probably don't know exactly what that means, you know, by the abundance of your traffic. Arnold Fruchtenbaum, he says this, he says, "Satan sinned by the abundance of his traffic. This Hebrew expression means to go about from person to person or from place to place." And he says the picture is that when unrighteousness was found in Satan, he went from angel to angel trying to secure their allegiance by slandering God. And one third of the innumerable number of angels was convinced by Satan and joined him, but two thirds did not. So the specific sin here was of the act of slandering God from angel to angel. And this act of sin originated from the sin of pride. So again, just as Satan went from person to person trying to basically slander the Most High, so that's what we see with Absalom here in this bigger conspiracy. But let's look also at Absalom's undoing. It's actually in chapter 18. You'll remember that Hushai, David's man on the inside, gave the counsel that Absalom himself should actually lead the men out. He should go. And Absalom thought that was a valid and worthwhile plan, and so that's what he did. And so in verse 6 of chapter 18, it says, "Then the people went out into the field against Israel, and the battle took place in the forest of Ephraim. And the people of Israel were defeated there before the servants of David, and the slaughter there was great." That day was great, 20,000 men. And it says, "For the battle there was spread over the whole countryside, and the forest devoured more people that day than the sword devoured. Now Absalom happened to meet the servants of David, for Absalom was riding on his mule, and the mule went under the thick branches of a great oak, and his head caught fast in the oak, so he was left hanging between heaven and earth, while the mule that was under him kept going. Now, I don't know what you think about that. That's a strange way to go out. Strange ending to the story. But it's interesting when you look into this. There's three things I just wanted to say. The Jewish historian Josephus talks about this, and he actually says it was actually Absalom's hair that got all entangled in the branches. And so his head was lodged, but his hair was also all entangled. And so he was stuck in this tree, you know, his beautiful hair, his long flowing mane. Basically the source of his pride became his downfall. And so obviously even that itself is a picture of Satan, how it was the source of his pride that became his downfall. In Ezekiel, just read it out, this same passage, chapter 28, verse 17, it says, "Your heart became proud on account of your beauty, and you corrupted your wisdom because of your splendor, so I threw you to the earth." So it's that whole thought of the pride that led to Satan's downfall. But we also see in this passage about Absalom that his undoing was by a tree. His undoing was by a tree. You've got to think about it in terms of, for Absalom, he thought that this was basically the point of his victory. He was going out. This was, you know, this was a sure victory for him. This is when he's going to fully take the throne, and he's going to be the victor. He's going to be like the Most High. He's going to be king over Israel, if you like. But then it's a tree of all things that becomes his undoing. In terms of the picture and the type, we know you can imagine what Satan thought when he got Judas to betray Jesus, when he saw his plan actually starting to work out. Yeah, he'd got the Romans as well to crucify Jesus, and he actually watches on as Jesus dies on a tree, and he would have thought, this is my greatest victory, up until the point when he found out that it actually wasn't a defeat for the Son of God. It was actually, that tree was actually defeating him, if you like. That cross was actually judging him himself. What he thought was going to be his greatest victory turned out to be his greatest defeat. I'll just read out a couple of verses to do with that. Speaking about the cross, 1 Corinthians says this. It says, "None of the rulers of this age understood it, for if they had, they would not have crucified the Lord of glory." People debate whether the rulers of this age, whether it's talking about the spirit world in terms of Satan, or whether it's just talking about the rulers on earth. But taken as the spirit world, Satan had no idea that this tree was actually going to be his downfall. He thought it was going to be his glorious victory that he had won. And in Colossians, talking about the cross again, it says, "Having disarmed the powers and authorities, he made a public," that's Jesus, "made a public," or God, "made a public spectacle of them, triumphing over them by the cross." So it was the cross that actually disarmed, it says, these powers and authorities in the spirit world. Finally, just in this passage, when I was reading it, I thought it's kind of a strange thing to say. It says his head caught fast in the oak, and he was left hanging between heaven and earth. Kind of that left hanging between heaven and earth. You know, you'd think he was just left hanging in the tree or something. But it kind of, he was left hanging between heaven and earth. He became someone kind of in the middle, if you like. And again, the only thing I think it's to do with, in terms of the type, is that when it talks about Satan, it talks about how he's now the ruler of the power of the air. He's been basically cast down from heaven. Does his business off earth, but they seem to have this realm in the atmosphere, in the air, somehow. somehow between heaven and earth, if you like. So there's a number of interesting little parallels. We'll just finish with the last one. In 2 Samuel, are you still there? In chapter 18, we'll just read from verse 14. Joab gets to hear about what's happened to Absalom, that he's stuck and he's hanging in this tree. And Joab was, he led David's fighting men. He was quite impulsive at times and did some things he shouldn't have. But when he heard about it in verse 14, it says, "Then Joab said, 'I will not waste time here with you.' So he took three spears in his hand and he thrust them through the heart of Absalom while he was yet alive in the midst of the oak. And 10 young men who carried Joab's armor gathered around. They struck Absalom and they killed him. Then Absalom blew the trumpet, and the people returned from pursuing Israel, for Joab restrained the people. And they took Absalom and they cast him into a deep pit in the forest, and they erected over him a very great heap of stones. And all Israel fled, each to his tent." So we just finally see that the end of Absalom basically involved a deep pit. Which again, if you think about it in terms of Satan, at the moment Satan is free to roam, go back and forth, to and fro. Talks about him being a roaring lion, going back and forth. But we know when we read of his end, it involves the deep pit. That passage in Isaiah 14 that I read out before, where Satan says, "I will ascend to the tops of the clouds, I'll make myself like the Most High." The next verse says, "But you are brought down to the grave, to the depths of the pit." And we know also from Revelation, before Jesus sets up his throne and rules again over Israel, just like David had to come back and be the rightful ruler in Israel here. In Revelation, it talks about, "And I saw an angel coming down out of heaven, having the key to the abyss," which is, that deep, bottomless pit, "and holding in his hand a great chain, and he seized the dragon, the ancient serpent, who is the devil or Satan, and he bound him for 1,000 years, and he threw him into the abyss and locked and sealed it over him to keep him from deceiving the nations any more until the 1,000 years were ended." All right. But we've seen that in the days of David, there's this betrayal going on within a bigger betrayal. There's a conspiracy within a bigger conspiracy. And obviously that played out in the betrayal of Jesus. There's a betrayal of Judas, but it's actually part of this far bigger ongoing betrayal. And we even see the hand of Satan in Judas's betrayal. Just from John, talks about after Jesus said, "I tell you the truth, one is going to betray me," it goes on to say, "Then dipping the piece of bread, he gave it to Judas Iscariot, son of Simon. And as soon as Judas took the bread, Satan entered into him. And what you're about to do, do quickly," Jesus told him. But not one at the meal understood why Jesus had said this to him. So we see this bigger betrayal going on. The betrayal of Judas is just a part of this wider plan, if you like. So what I want to look at next time, because that's kind of like laying the whole foundation of the whole thing. But these things aren't just sort of necessarily fulfilled once. A lot of these things in the Bible, there are like patterns that keep playing out. And this whole thing actually tries to get played out even in our lives in terms of Satan wanting to get us to betray God. Going from people to people saying, "The king's not really listening to you. You'd get far better if you came with me." And it also, this whole thing is going to get portrayed and played out actually on a global scale as well for all the world to see. Yes, it had a major fulfillment with Jesus, but it's actually going to get ultimately fulfilled again with a betrayal that's still coming. And that's really going to be played out with the nation of Israel. and Satan's man, Antichrist, who Israel is going to trust like a friend and ultimately be betrayed and let down. So we'll look at that next time, more the end times thing of it, and also the personal aspect. But I just wanted to sort of lay the whole foundation of it today in terms of this whole story, this betrayal within a betrayal. All right.